Hello and welcome everybody to Flickr Effect. It is Monday, March 4th, 2024. I'm Dave Lott. Joining me is Bobby Jackson. How's it going, Bobby?
Good. How's it going?
Pretty good. It's been a while. It's been a minute.
A long while.
Yes, it has been a long while. More on that in a second. But also here is Michelle Hillard. How's it going, Michelle?
Hello, everyone. Hello. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Michelle. Long time no hear. 4C.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. We've taken a bit of a break. We had already taken a break before the last episode. And
we took another break.
Basically, the break has continued, really, is what has happened. But I don't know about you guys. I would like to try to make this more regular from here on out. And hopefully we'll do that. And we'll see what happens.
Right. Well, I'm free, so I'm good with that.
Good. Excellent. All right, we're going to make that happen. We'll see each other next week then.
Let's do this.
Sounds like a plan.
It's a plan. But this week, this episode, we have one agenda, one subject to discuss, and that is the new film Dune Part 2, which is now in theaters. We are recording this on the Monday after it was released, so it's only been out a handful of days. It is time to talk about it. Dune is what has finally brought us back together.
Yay!
Who would have thought that'd be the movie that would get us back all on the same page?
Right. But yeah, let's get into it. Before we start, as usual, we'll probably split this up into two parts, a spoiler-free review, and if we feel like we want to start digging into spoiler territory, we will give plenty of warning before we do that and talk spoilers later on in the review. But for those of you who haven't seen the movie yet and are listening, don't worry, we aren't going to jump right into spoilers from the get-go. We'll give you a heads up before we do that. So, Dune. Michelle, look like you wanted to say something.
No.
You leaned in. I was like, what's up, dude?
I don't know.
It's got nothing. So, I'm gonna guess that most of you listening have seen Dune Part 2, but maybe there are some of you who have not. But either way, I would imagine that you have heard about the critical reception that this movie has received since its release. It has been pretty highly praised. What has it got on Rotten Tomatoes as of this recording? A 93% with a 95% audience score. There was a moment there, I remember hearing, that it had dethroned the Shawshank Redemption on the IMDb top 250 mm-hmm. movies list. As of right now, it is dropped back down a little bit. It's got a 9.0 star rating, and they have it at 11th place right now, which is still quite good when you think of all movies all time. What's the cinema score? Cinema scores A. I'm not as familiar with Metacritic, but Metacritic has it at a 79 with 62 reviews.
That seems low, but...
But I'm not... I never really pay attention to Metacritic, but...
I don't pay that much
attention. I don't know. I know it's a thing. Some people pay attention to it. Box office-wise, it did quite well. Brought in $82 million here domestically. Over the weekend for the number one spot. But anyway, it has been, I don't know about you guys and when you first saw it, but, going into this theater, there was no doubt I had heard that, wow, this movie is amazing and this movie is incredible. And going in with expectations like that is a whole other subject. But, yeah, we're here to discuss it and see if indeed it is as good as everyone is saying. Because, yeah, it's hard to get away from all the praise for Dune Part 2. And Bobby, we were going to have the bowl decide who goes first, but you volunteered yourself to share your thoughts.
I felt like I could go first on this one just because I don't think it's going to be any surprise, but I fall right in line with most of what the critics and the audience score is in terms of how I like this movie. I first saw it on the Sunday that they had the fan event, and I got to see it in IMAX, the 70 millimeter, and it was fantastic just getting to see it in that presentation. But this is then I ended up seeing it again on the Thursday that it came out in Dolby. So for me, obviously, I went to see it twice, so that speaks a lot in terms of how I enjoyed it. But I think for outside of the fact that I really love this movie, that what I like about it so much is that it felt like a good evolution from the first movie to the second one, just a natural evolution, because it really does pick up just a few minutes after that first movie ends. And it just builds upon itself and pays off so many different things that we set up in that first movie. And just from a visual standpoint, this is one of those movies I really feel like is a theater experience, because you sit there and you're taking it all in and you're in awe of just how seamless the effects look. This world, you would believe that it's real, that it's somewhere out there, because it just looks that good. I feel like I remember seeing it the first time and thinking to myself, when was the last time I just felt like this world felt so real that it just didn't even look like special effects were being done? And I think it was another Denis movie, which was Arrival. And I just remember having that sense of watching it outside of seeing The Last Dune, that it just feels like it's a place where this all feels authentic. Nothing feels out of place in terms of, okay, that doesn't kind of seem right, or that doesn't seem like that could happen or real. But I just felt like there was this movie that just swelled from the first one. And it, one of the things that I think I enjoyed more in this one than in the first one, obviously, by the nature of what it is you get to spend more time with the Fremen, and you get to see how their society works and the inner workings, and also seeing more of some of the leadership that comes out of there from some of the other characters you see, like Javier Bardem's character. And it's just so much more of a rich world when you see the second movie, that I just don't have very many faults in the movie. It's just like I have nitpicks, but no actual faults. And it's so rare to get that these days, where you can just sit back and watch a movie and just be like, yeah, that was excellent on so many levels. And you just can't help but think that, at least I think about it, if this had came out last year, it would have been a very nice Oscar Sunday to watch this coming weekend, to see Oppenheimer and this duke it out, to see which would come out with the top prize and some of the other categories, because this feels to me like this is going to be a front runner for next year's Oscars. And it just puts itself on every level, like in the way that like a Return of the King did, when that was the end of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And you just know that it was going to come in there and just shut everything down for everything else in every other category. This is what that feels like. It just feels like seeing someone doing the thing that they do at the top of their game with Denis, and it's just watching this unfold, and you just can't help but wait and be excited and anticipate another movie. And you're just waiting, like I feel like I'm just waiting right now for Warner Brothers to go ahead and say, okay, Dune Part 3 is greenlit and it'll be coming out in, you know, who knows, like summer of 2028 or something, who knows. But I'm ready for them to go ahead and say it, because I'm super anxious to see it. And it's got me to the point where when I read the books, I read up to and through this point, so I don't know beyond it. And it's bugging me, because I feel like, either do I want to go into the next book, or do I want to wait, or do I want to watch the series that came out on Sci-Fi that goes a little bit further? because having to wait until Denis is ready to do this third one feels like it's going to be a long time. And I don't know if I want to wait. But ultimately, yes, I love this movie. I've seen it twice, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to see it another time after this because I just watched the first one again with my son. He's never seen it. And before watching it, he was like hesitant because he heard it was boring and slow. But by the time it ended, he was like, okay, I see what it's about now. And I was like, okay, then next week we're going to go watch the second one. So he's pumped up. So I'm like happy that he's into it because that was the complaint a lot of times from that first one is how slow and boring it was. So I felt like if he was already on board for that first one, he's going to love the second one. And I think that's where I feel like most people are. If you didn't quite like the first one because it was a little slow, I feel like you should give this one a chance because it's not like it's super fast paced in the second one. It still takes its time with things, but I do feel like it pays off so many things that were set up in the first one that you would enjoy it if you didn't quite get the thing that you were looking for out of the first one.
Michelle, what about you? What did you think of Dune Part 2?
I really mostly all just praise for this film. I think this is the pinnacle of what I think good sci-fi filmmaking is and should be and should always strive for. I think Denis Villeneuve just knocked out of the park. I think this is a spectacular film, and I think it's really good storytelling. I also, this film is a little bit different. Like we've said before, the first film really kind of takes its time and its pacing, and it really helps you get to feel enveloped by the situation, by being on Arrakis, by understanding a little bit of the Fremen that are already there, by understanding a little bit of the background between the different families and the Dukes, and understanding a little and getting that base knowledge in. But then this one, it picks up right where we left off, and there's so much information that they have put into this film, and it's something that there is a lot of action in this film, but it's not just action-packed moment to moment to moment to moment, but the story is constantly like boom, boom, point, 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 thing, thing, thing. Like, it's constantly building and constantly adding and giving you information. Like, every scene is informational, and so there's a lot that's getting covered throughout the whole film. And as much as there is to go over, it does it well, and it really does it in my opinion, all that information in a pretty short time span, given how much information's in this film. I think the cast is outstanding. Again, like, it's just, which isn't surprising. I think Rebecca Ferguson does a spectacular job in this. And the newcomers, Florence Pugh coming in as Princess Irulan, I think she really does embody, I think, that character and what I think I had in my head when I was listening to the audiobook of Dune. But then, Justin Butler really, as Fade Rautha, he really took on that role, and he ate it up, and he did a good job, I think. But I think the film is very good. I have extremely nitpicky-ish book things when it comes to this film, things that I'm like, overall, though, this film is spectacular. It is, not surprisingly, visually stunning. But I don't know. I feel like there's so much, and all I have is just gushing praise for this film, and I could just ramble on and on and on and on. But no, it's really good. And it's funny to listen to Denis and his interviews and to understand, like, for him, he's like, this one was a lot to shoot. It took a long time to do a lot of these scenes. And I get it because they're so layered and there's so much happening. And for him to take such I'm going to call it a naturalistic approach to his special effects, it shows, it pays off, and nothing feels fake the entire time you're watching it. And I think it can be challenging to compare this film to other sci-fi films that are out there, because some of them do come off as, I don't want to say fake, but it just comes off as not realistic looks to it. But this, I mean, this makes me fearful of going into deserts because you can tell there could totally be worms in there. Like, I don't, you know, like, it's crazy. He just did such a great job with this. I can't even, I still keep thinking about this film, and I'm looking forward to going back and seeing it again because I keep thinking about it. But that's me.
That's you.
How about David?
So I was going to say, like, going back to, you know, how we started the episode talking about the high praise that this has gotten. And I think, you know, for one, it was actually, you know, before I'd even seen this movie, it was kind of exciting. It's exciting to have such buzz and excitement about a movie that basically seems like it's getting universal praise. And I'm like, I haven't even seen this. And this makes me so happy that I'm like, wow, people seem to really love this. And everyone is into it. And I'm scrolling through Twitter and 75% of the posts I see are about Dune. Like, this is awesome. At the same time, like, I would argue to anyone who has not seen this movie yet, and, you know, you're seeing all this praise, it's like, it's exciting, but at the same time, I feel like it's never a good thing to go in with expectations that are just like, is this going to change my life? Which is like, you know, I think some people could possibly go into a movie like this based on everything they're hearing. And I mean, I was finding myself going, okay, I'm going into this. I think obviously it's going to be good, but I don't want to get like too pumped up. Like, this is going to, like, I'm going to be a different person walking out of this. But I was not disappointed at all. I mean, the movie's fantastic. And, you know, everyone is right. This movie is as good as everyone is saying. And, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record and just repeat everything that you guys have already said. So I feel like my spoiler-free thoughts may be kind of short. But, yeah, it's an experience to be had in a movie theater. It's the kind of movie theater experience that you don't get that often. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of times we'll say, oh, you got to see this in a theater. And, you know, Oppenheimer, for example, had to see that in the movie theater. This is another one. It must be seen on a big screen. I was thinking, you know, if you're someone who... maybe you didn't love Dune Part 1. Maybe you thought it was good, but it was kind of boring, or you really just couldn't even, you know, you just couldn't even get through it because you thought it was a little boring, but there were things you liked about it. I will say this is a movie that makes Dune Part 1 even better. And I'm saying that as someone who loved Dune Part 1. I didn't need it to be any better, but... It, you know, it's the completion of that story arc to a point, without getting into spoilers, to a point. But at least takes the story to a far enough place that, you know, it feels a little more complete. And I would argue, if you're one of those people, maybe give Dune Part 1 a rewatch, or finish it if you haven't finished it. Go see Dune Part 2, and I think you'll be happy that you did. The movie's incredible. But going back to what I was saying about expectations, I bring that up because no matter how good this movie is, and I think it is incredible, I still think it's, you know, it's never a good idea to go into a movie with expectations too high. No matter how good the movie is, there's still a chance that you'll have thoughts in your head about the movie you're going into. And if it doesn't quite live up to maybe some of the ridiculously high expectations you might have based on what you've been hearing, you might be disappointed. And I mean, it doesn't seem like that's happening with this. I've watched video after video of people going, okay, I'm gonna walk in and see if this is as good as I'm hearing, and then they come out and they're like, wow, no, it really is that good. So it doesn't seem to be the case, but I just gave that warning just in case you're still in the boat of having not seen it yet and you're hearing all these good things. The expectation thing can always still ruin an experience, in my opinion. But no, I think this movie is hidden incredibly good. It was as good, if not better, than I was expecting. Anything else before we talk spoilers? All right. So from here on out, for those listening, if you have not seen Dune Part 2 yet, we would suggest you stop this episode now. We are going to talk spoilers for the film from here on out. So once you go check the movie out, though, please come back and listen to the rest of this. We would love to have you back. So with that, spoilers from here on out, guys. Have at it.
Well, I don't, it's hard to say where to start with spoilers, other than I feel like I want to highlight certain aspects. And one of them is something that you see in the trailer, where I forget the name of the place specifically, but it's where the Harkonnens live. And when you see that black and white of how it looks when Fade Rotha is in the arena and he's fighting, it just looks so cool to have that section there. And even just Austin Butler in general, I thought he was great as Fade Rotha, and he's just vicious, and he just is such a good, excellent kind of like character to just sit back and watch, because he's just a nasty kind of individual. And I just thought that transition when you see the Baron go from in his chair and he's scrolling across and he's in color, and then he goes into where the light is, or where it's blotted out, I suppose. And then you see it turn to black and white. I was just like, man, that's so good. And it's so clever to even think of that. And I just thought, like, this is, again, an example of how well this movie is shot and thought through of all the different things that they do. So for me, that was definitely a highlight scene in terms of that. Even, again, to just highlight the other aspects of the film in terms of just how effortlessly the scenes of the special effects are. It just seems like they don't have any kind of actual fakeness to it. It just is remarkable to me. I'm looking too. I'm like, does anything look off or weird or a little bit? And it could be, and I missed it, but I just was in awe of just the visuals. And I just feel like that's one of those things that I keep going back to most of the time, because I think, like, with the story itself, it's sort of a benefit, but a little bit of a hindrance, because it's an old story, but it's been told multiple times in multiple ways since Dune was first out. And so it's like you kind of understand and kind of can see the way the story can go. But at the same time, it's like that's just part of what makes it good. Like Michelle mentioned, it's a lot of the performances. And one of the ones that I particularly enjoyed, again, was Javier Bardem as Stilgar. There was just these times where he was, to me, funny in the things that he was saying, especially in his belief of Paul being the Isan al-Ghayb, I think it's pronounced. I forget. But that he would just be so impressed. And like that one part where he's like, Paul is like, no, you guys are the ones who should be taking the power and everything. And then he turns around and it cuts to the scene, and he's explaining to the other ones, see, he's so humble, and that shows that he's the one. And it's just like the timing of it is so good, and he's so good at it. Especially, like, I'll sit there sometimes and I'm watching Javier Bardem, and I'm sitting there thinking, man, it's the same dude who was in No Country for Old Men, and so menacing and scary. And yet in this, he's just got that elegance and power and leadership about him. And he's just so fun to watch in this movie. And I just felt like you get that with a lot of different performances. And that, for me, there's just so many different things to enjoy every time I watched it so far. And we'll probably do so again when I see it again.
No, I agree. I think for me, one of the standout scenes was definitely the pit fight on the planet where the Harkonnens live for Fade Rotha.
Geddi Prime, I think.
Geddi Prime, that's right. And listening in an interview, Denis Villeneuve said that he shot that entire scene in
infrared.
Yeah. You know, and they have to do some stuff to it in post-production, but it's shot in infrared. And like, he, I guess, like, just kind of went to the studio, was like, we're shooting it infrared. And they were kind of like, well, okay then. And he was like, cool. And they're like, don't screw it up.
And I think, now we're like trying to remember exactly what he said in an interview. I think it was almost, I forget his cinematographer's name, I think came to him with the idea and he kind of went with it. If I remember correctly, but also, you know, him having to point out, like, you're shooting in infrared, there's no getting the color back. There's no like, well, we don't like the way this looks, we'll put color back in post. Like, no, this is it. It's going to be like this.
This is how it shot.
And it gives everything that funky, like, you see blood vessels under the skin kind of look and stuff. So it's not just normal black and white. It definitely has a kind of weird softness to the, like, skin and
almost an iridescence.
Yeah.
It's impressive to think that that's how he shot it. And he told the studio, like, this is it. And they're like, okay. And he just let him do it. He was like, I mean, it paid off, but it was kind of a gamble to do that.
Yeah.
But I don't know, just talking about this though, just also like, not that I was worried for Denis Villeneuve's career or anything, but it's like, especially like after Blade Runner, there was a part of me that's like, man, this guy's so talented, and I really hope like how this has turned out is not gonna like, you know, affect his career in negative ways. And then Dune Part One comes out during the pandemic, and you know, like, it was released on HBO Max, I guess, right at the same time that it was, you know, released in theaters, and there was that whole
Theaters had just reopened. Like, it was a whole, like, you know, people were still like not sure about going back out in public, and
It's just so nice to see like a movie of his now that everyone is like, my God. I mean, you know, we all loved Arrival too. I'm not saying he's not like he's never made.
Right, but like, you know, not everybody's seen Arrival. Not everybody loved Arrival. Not everybody like touted Arrival. And I personally think Arrival's an excellent film. And, you know, I think it just, I feel like it's weird that this is the film that's really put Denis Villeneuve into the zeitgeist, and people know how to pronounce his name correctly, and people can, you know, they're like, oh, I know what you're talking about now. Right. Whereas I feel like a few years ago, I'd say his name and they'd be like, who are you talking about? Like,
right.
But now he's up there in the, you know, strata list of high directors.
No, anyway.
No, for sure.
Yeah.
But it kind of hinged on this working out. And it did, thank goodness.
You know.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say real quick that I remember, I think it was before the fan event happened on that Sunday, maybe a couple days before. And it was definitely when the press, I think, were seeing the movie. And there was a spoiler that had came out, and I had no frame of reference, but because they had shown I can't think of her name all of a sudden.
Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yes, thank you. So they had showed her, and that because she had was on the red carpet, and they were like, "Oh, she's in the movie," and then I saw that as a article or a headline or something. And then I was like, huh, I wonder who she could be playing. Because I didn't really think too far on it. And sort of like what you mentioned, David, where it had been so long since I had listened to the book that I really had forgot a certain amount of things until some things happened. And even then, when some things happened, I just kind of didn't remember it exactly from the book. And so it wasn't until towards the end of the movie that I even realized, oh, that's his sister. It was so captured by everything else going on. And then it wasn't until at some point A little bit before they showed her, it was still like the baby, and I was like, it kind of popped into my head. I was like, oh, maybe. And then sure enough, and I was like, oh, okay. So now I was like on board for that, and it's nice little kind of precursor to what we'll see, I guess, going into the next movie. But that was just one of those things where it was spoiled for me, but it didn't spoil it for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I know, I think she appeared on the red carpet, like at, I forget which city it was. And then suddenly,
Paris,
the trades were like, yes. Okay, yeah, Anya Taylor-Joy is in the film. And, you know, I know Michelle and I, we talked about it. It's like, I think we had speculated it must be like the sister.
Like, it's got to be the sister. Mm. But at the same time, I was kind of like, I guess it's got to be in like a vision because
she's not old enough, like, ever to be like a
not till the very end of the age. Not till the very end of the book, and even that's kind of
she's like a 2 or 3 year old at the end of the book, like nowhere near the age you see her to, like, as Anya Taylor-Joy is, you know,
which has got to be something leading into Messiah,
right? But yeah, we're left going, I guess it's her, but it must be definitely different in the book, which it was, you know.
Yeah.
And then that goes into, you know, while we're talking about one difference in the book, I definitely get it. I can't imagine if he had depicted an infant kid the way, you know, the sister is written in the book. Which I say that, you would like to think that if there's a third movie, then he'll have to go down that road. But yeah. This is a kid who is already talking to her mother in the womb, and then, like, when they're born is, like, kind of weird because they're basically already pretty intelligent and, you know.
So I decided to start to re-listen to the second half of Dune today, and I'm at that point where basically there's a conversation about her birth. Like, basically at one point, Jessica has her, but they don't really go into the birth in the book. But then through a conversation later where, you know, Jameis's wife, who is now a concubine of Paul's because of his situation with Jameis, so she comes in with her, and she's just a 2-year-old little toddler, but she talks like she's like probably like a 4 or 5 year old. And then they started talking about the whole birth situation of how, like, basically she was birthed and, like, she would just, like, know things. And she would, like, it was just how strange she is. But even past the whole birth situation, just the fact that this 2-year-old speaking level is about a 5-year-old and knowledge level is about a 65-year-old. Right. Like, she understands sexual nuances and jokes and she has history that goes back hundreds of thousands of years, because basically in the womb, she basically became like a reverend mother, an unborn child, basically, because she got the same information that Jessica got. And then Jessica and her had this whole like mental leak. Like, it's going to be a very interesting Dune 3, which will get greenlit. I have absolutely no doubts. Will be very interesting to go down this entire path with this character.
If indeed they have to depict that kind of thing on screen, or if he jump over it or something, I don't know. It would be interesting. But I haven't read Dune Messiah either. But from what I hear, it's a book that definitely goes into really weird territory that it seems like everyone is saying, like, if this ever comes to screen, it's going to be interesting to see. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think
I've heard things about it that I'm like, I don't know how people will accept something like that, for example, like if it's just going to go into odd territory. Or I'm saying this, I haven't read it, but
right. I could see where maybe they don't even have to get into so much of the odd stuff. They could really just wrap up the whole Atreides situation, Messiah situation, and the basically the war that is now built and is ensuing, and how that's going to pan out. But I think for me, I'm trying to figure out how to explain this. So my one thing that I kind of bumped on in the film, if I had to be like, was there anything, absolutely anything, I'd be like, this would be the one thing. I had a challenging time believing the relationship between Paul and Chaney being at a specific level by the end of this film. And I say that because all of these events, this entire film basically takes place in under, what, 7 months? 6 months? Because the child's not even born. Mm-hmm. So from zero to where they end at in like a very short amount of time, but they're supposed to be, I don't know, it was hard for me to buy into their relationship being at that level in such a short span. Whereas in the book, it builds over like 3 years. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't book on that at all.
It was hard for me. I was like, I don't. I don't know. I don't know if there's the chemistry. Like, it just didn't come to me. It did not come through in the film. Huh? And I'm saying this, I like Zendaya as Chaney. I like Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides. I don't think the two of them have a lot of chemistry.
I don't know. It works for me. I really didn't bump on it at all. Really? So no, not at all. There's nitpicky things I bumped on, but not that.
I'm going to be the poor man out in the left field here on this one.
Bobby. I don't know what you think. Is she crazy?
No, I would say crazy. Because when she said it, I was like, yeah, I can see that. I didn't bump up against it. But when she said it, I was like, okay, yeah, that's true. But yeah, in the time that I was watching it, I guess because I know it from the movie or from the books, I just bought into it as it is what it is. So I didn't even really think too much about it in terms of the time and would they have really been at that point? Because obviously they are, to a certain degree, fast forwarding within the movie,
right.
Of certain things being compressed for time.
Yeah.
So I just sort of figured, okay, it's over time that they're not showing every little time that they're connecting, but you get kind of the gist of that they've grown closer, and so it is what it is. But yeah, I can understand it, but at the time I didn't bump up against it. No.
I mean, I feel like I wasn't bumping up against it a lot really during, but like as the movie was progressing and like we get to the final end scene where it is the, you know, the death fight between Paul Atreides and Fade Rautha for the Emperor's, position. And I don't know, like, I mean, it gave off the vibe of angry girlfriend at boyfriend and not like angry life partner against life partner having to make a horrible decision.
Okay.
I was like, yeah, they're not there yet. Like the connection is just not there yet to me, but
yeah, I mean, I guess with that in mind, yeah. I mean, even if it is, which I guess you could argue it is in this movie, not like it is in the book, and that they're not as far along in their relationship. So it kind of is angry girlfriend and angry boyfriend.
It is. Yeah. Because it's.
But what I guess for me, it still works though in that
context. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, she's mostly, and she expresses throughout the movie, which is this kind of juxtaposition, I guess, if you will, that she's obviously attracted to him and, you know, finds something attractive about him, but yet she doesn't like this whole, like, hey, I'm the
chosen one, the Messiah.
And you know, she expresses it throughout the movie, mm-hmm. that she's not right. into this and doesn't hold back, and that seems to be the main basis for I love this guy, but you know, his mom had him drink this shit and now he's really changed, and
right,
you know, I don't know, I guess I didn't bump up against it. I guess I didn't see it as like, well, they're acting like they've been together years. I'm like, no, I feel like they're still kind of acting like they've been together a few months to almost a year, basically. I don't know. But that's just me.
So, David, you did mention there are some things you kind of bumped up against.
Yeah. I mean, I say that and I'm like, I was sitting here expecting to have to, okay, now I've got to bring up something. And I'm like, do I have anything though? I'm like, and I mean, I'm thinking out loud right now. So, forgive me if I watch this again and I go, nope, I'm crazy. I was wrong about what I said on the podcast. And this is, Michelle's going to be like, I'm probably going to blow your mind.
Well, maybe I'll be completely wrong the second time watching and be like, oh, never mind. I don't feel that way
either. No, and this is more casting choice, I guess. And I love this actress. I love Florence Uh-oh. Pugh. But I don't, I guess of all the performances, her performance as Princess Irulan was good. It was fine. But it wasn't like, there was something about it that felt a little dry. For me, I'm not saying that Princess Irulan is this like really super nuanced like character in the book or anything, right. Or at least in this first book. But I don't know. I'm not saying her performance is bad, but I guess if I were to look back at this movie and go, there was one casting choice that I would doubt. Maybe I guess that might be the one.
I think what it is. I enjoy her as this character, but I think it's because Florence, I think they went a little bit differently with this character. She's definitely, so I feel like in the book she's portrayed a little more like ethereal and I think a little younger and a little bit more naive. Whereas in this, she's definitely not so ethereal. She's definitely more grounded. She has common sense that has been taught to her and warfare and like people, like how to work people, like she's been taught these things and she comes across as knowledge at a younger age. I wouldn't say very young because I feel like in the book she comes across like she's somewhere in her late teens, very early 20s, whereas this I think she comes across more as like, I'm learned and knowledged but I am in my mid 20s. And not so ethereal, light, and airy. She's very grounded. And I think that's more the portrayal, I think, that they went with this. And I like that, actually. I think that made it more... Well, she'll be an interesting character to see continue. Whereas in the book, I always kind of felt like she's kind of like, ugh, she's kind of airheady.
Again, that's my opinion. Super nitpicky. I'm not really... like I don't have a problem with her, but I guess it's more like if I had to pick a performance that wasn't as good as the others, that's...
My I would go. Personality pick as far as not feeling like their performance was up to the level of everyone else. And this is more nitpicky again. It's not like, oh...
And we're just trying to find things to be angry about.
Well, this is only just predicated off of what David said. I have other things that I was really more or less thinking about in terms of nitpicks. But the far as performance-wise, I would say Dave Bautista, it's like I felt like he did what was required of him to do within the role. But I don't know if it was an acting choice or... specifically to the character, but I felt like a lot of the times whenever he was on screen, he either seemed out of breath or had a bewildered look on his face. That he's just like, and I was like, I don't understand. It's like he doesn't know where he's at in a way, weird right. sort of way. And so you see that too, David, because I was like, is it just me or is that?
Yeah.
And I mean, as another. I would agree. And I mean, I love Dave Bautista and I don't know. I'm not saying he's bad in this.
I think he plays a character that doesn't have a lot of lines to begin with. And I think it's a character that in the story, it's not a person that really talks that much, but his story arc is he's the top dog. And then he starts screwing up and then he starts doubting himself. And then he kind of becomes a low-lifey, I don't know who I am anymore kind of situation. And then everybody just feeds off of that and they just, you know.
But yeah, the bewildered face is, that's frequent.
No, that definitely happened a few times.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm glad it wasn't just me.
No.
Just
sort of,
you know,
I don't know if he knew what to do with his character because it's so, it's a part of the story where this character doesn't know what he is as a being anymore, I guess. Dave didn't know what to do with it. He just, like, befuddled. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word for it, befuddled.
I don't know. Maybe he was like, I don't know what to do with this guy anymore because he's not the same person he was in the first part.
Yeah. Even in the first one, he's kind of like that too.
He kind of is, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, we've seen, he had a very small role, but yeah. He had a really small role in this, but it really worked. And I thought it was a really good performance when he appeared in Blade Runner 2049. Mm-hmm. And I know I've heard interviews about how he really has his goal set to get away from certain type of action movies and really like be an actor. And that's great. And I think anybody is capable of doing that if you really dedicate yourself to it. And I think he is too. But then I see like him in Dune Part 1 and Part 2. And yeah, this character is a little, it's supposed to be kind of this over the top, you know, super like I'm just gonna scream all the time because I'm pissed off, and you know
it's not anything, a multifaceted kinda, character,
and yeah, and I feel like it doesn't help him
develop, grow.
I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I think you get it.
Yeah, we got you.
Yeah, I get it, totally get it. Yeah, I felt like, okay, so the nitpicks that I do have, I don't even know that they're nitpicks, because I was going to ask the two of you about it. Because I felt like I must have missed something or wasn't thinking it through in the way that it's meant to be. And so I'm just sort of lost on it. But one of the things was that when Fade Rotha comes to Arrakis and he's like taking over, and they go and to the where the Fremens are staying in the rocks and
yeah, they go to Siege Tabor, which is the main city.
Yeah, and he's like bombing it and bringing them basically out of there, and they had to leave. I was like, why did they never do that before? I don't know if I could figure out how come they just didn't do that in the first place. If they knew where the location of it was, why did it take that long for them to do that?
I don't think that they did know where Siege Tabor was. That was the whole thing, was that it was a very secret place. The Sieges are all very secretive, but Siege Tabor was looked upon as one of the holier places in the north part. And it's not well, only Fremen know of it. Like, and even then, only some Fremen even know how to get to it. And that's why there's always so much. That's how there's always so much security, right? And so, like, I was thinking, it's funny because I was sitting there in the theater. That was one thing I was thinking. I was like, "Well, did Austin? Are they going to show a shot where Fade Rotha has some poor person telling him where it's at? Like some Fremen that he's like just tortured, and they've given up the location of it, because the location of Siege Tabor specifically is supposed to not be known." To like, that was the big thing, the Harkonnens couldn't find it, and then suddenly all of a sudden Fade Rotha finds it and then blows it, you know, into oblivion. So it, to me, that did kind of come out of, well, wait, how did we go from nobody knows where it is other than Fremen to he shows up with his battleship and just blows it out of the, like, what? I was kind of confused by that.
Okay,
I'll be honest, I guess I just kind of accepted it as a, he must have figured it out. Somehow they figured it out. And obviously we're not going to see every little detail in the story. And we're just to kind of assume somehow he figured it out while Raban couldn't.
Right.
Mm. So I guess I get what you guys are saying. But at the same time, I don't know, when I watched it, I didn't bump against it because I just kind of was like, well, I guess something happened where he found it. And he's better at his job than Raban was.
Well, and I'll be honest. Like, because I'm re-listening to the book, I just heard the whole section that basically explains the whole, like, Siege Tabor thing. And I'm like, that doesn't happen in the book. And I think it's actually more interesting in the film than it is in the book. Because in the film, what happens basically is they send the women and children down to the south. They send all of them to the south. And the men actually just wind up leaving Siege Tabor. And they basically empty it out. because they're like, we're going to get found. And then they figured that if they all split up, it would be better off.
Right.
So I was like, in comparison, yeah, it was more interesting in the film to have it be located and them have to leave because of it.
Right.
Makes more interesting.
Okay, I can accept that. Yeah, but okay, so then that clears that for me, and that's good. So the second thing was that, and maybe this goes back to what David was saying in terms of there's a limited amount of time, so they can't show everything. But there's a scene where Paul drinks, what is it called? The
water of life.
Something of life, or I forget what it's called, but he drinks that liquid, and so he's like, you know, going through his thing. And then Chani arrives, but she arrives on a thropter that she was flying. I was like, when did they learn how to fly those actual vehicles? Because then even at the end of the movie, they get into the ships and are going into space to fight against the other houses that are going to be attacking. So like, did they say that they trained on these things and I missed it? Because I didn't know how she was able to fly one of those things.
I don't think that it's like that they necessarily specifically just trained on it. I think what it is they slowly acquire these things and then they hide them. From what I was understanding was like that thropper was wherever they were at in the south. And then she had to go from that siege to where they are for the holy location where the water is. And so the fastest way was actually for her to do that instead of just like getting on sand. Like she wasn't like going like miles and miles. I mean, she was going a distance, but she wasn't going just something that would take a whole day. She was just kind of going up the road. So I guess she was like, hey, we've got three thropters hiding somewhere. I'm going to take one. And she took one. I think some of the war, I wouldn't say war people, I guess their army, there's a name for what the Fremen call their like their warriors. I think they do kind of train on that stuff a little bit, but it's never like we see any of it or know of it. But I mean, even in the first film, they had a random thropter, I can't say it anymore, kind of hidden away towards the end of the film of the first one. And that's what Jessica and Paul jump into. So I think they kind of just have acquired these things over time and kind of keep them hidden until they need to utilize them. But I mean, as far as her learning how to fly it, who the heck knows? I mean, I guess at any point in time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess for me, again, it was just like, well, you know, obviously we're kind of fast forwarding through things and they've stolen them and they've slowly been taught by Paul. And I guess that's just, I didn't even think about it. And if I had thought about it, I'd have just been like, well, they're, even if they are just now newly acquiring the stuff, Paul's just kind of quickly taught them. And
yeah, I mean,
and I don't know. I didn't bump against that one either. Sorry.
No, and for me, it was just they stood out. And I was like, I must have missed something because it felt like it was something that.
Like, yeah, suddenly they have an ornithopter all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And knew how to fly it when I hadn't seen any of the Fremen flying any of the vehicles before and doing anything with any of the stuff that was from off world, really. So, yeah, it's kind of like, oh, okay. Maybe I missed something. But, yeah. I mean, outside of that, that's like literally it in terms of me having to question anything within the film.
Yeah, again, I was trying to think if there was like more plot kind of points that I was like bumped up against, and I wouldn't even think
it's like I bumped up against it, but I think the big thing was, you know, it was the realization that they were basically taking what occurs over about 3 years and kind of condensing it down into like a 6 to 8 month time period.
Right.
And I think once I kind of realized, okay, they're just kind of condensing it. Cool. Got it. You know, and then, because the big thing that David and I kind of, we left the theater, we're like, wait, I thought Jessica had already given birth by the time the whole like throne scene situation happened. So we both were a little bit thrown, but then it was like, I guess they just wanted to condense it all into this time frame and keep it all in this one position.
Yeah, that was the thing we were both like, we're not crazy, but now I feel like I'm doubting myself, and it's like in my brain, I couldn't exactly, like, I knew that his sister killed somebody, and for some reason my brain couldn't like remember that it, like, she's the one that kills the Baron. And
I didn't even remember that.
Yeah. But I knew, I had this like vision in my head of how the book plays out, about her like fooling him, fooling somebody. But then I'm like, wait,
this is the reason why I'm re-listening to this, is I'm like, weren't there like two major, like, I'm going to call them throne room scenes in the book? And I can't remember now. And so like, I'm listening to the book, cause I have to, now I'm just mostly like, what, am I remembering correctly? Am I remembering incorrectly? Like, but yeah, I was like, man, by this point, I definitely thought she was already born and was like a toddler, like, and talking to everybody in this conversation. Right. And it's not that it's a bad thing that they didn't do this. It was mostly just a me going, wait, am I crazy? No, maybe. Who knows?
I will say, the one thing that I could see somebody saying about this movie, other than what they already have said about it, would be that if they were trying to look at it through the lens of today, in the movies that we typically get, since this is such an old story, it's done in a lens of the old school, like you guys were saying, in terms of the white savior kind of aspect and stuff. There's that, but even beyond that, I feel like just as characters, old school way was very black and white. And today, more of these characters, like maybe the Baron or the Emperor or some of these characters, would be a little bit more nuanced and not be completely evil. There'd be a little bit of maybe some things that are sort of likable about them, but right. Then you're kind of like, well, they're the bad guy, I shouldn't be liking anything about them. But back then it was really much like that. It was just, this is the bad side, this is the good side. There's no sort of middle ground within any of these characters that are bad. And you get that pretty much throughout. Like anyone in House Harkonnen, there's no good in any of them at all. And so it's just kind of like, okay, they're the bad guys, you root against them. But if it was done today, I guess it would probably be a little bit more nuanced there.
Probably.
I'm curious to see the story continue to really wrap up, because I will say, like, this way the film ends, it doesn't like end on a wrap up note. They're definitely prepared to do a Dune 3. Seems to be greenlit.
Right. And going back to what you were saying, Bobby, about you being torn, like, if you want to read the next book or not. And I was thinking about that when you were saying it. I'm like, before I say anything, most likely, yes, I'm going to listen to or read the book probably at some point. But, you know, when it comes to like, oh, I'm so interested in seeing where these movies go that I can't wait till I read the book, it's like, now knowing the differences he has kind of made in the kind of trajectory of everybody, like mainly like Chani, like, who in the book was pretty supportive of everything he was doing.
Like, she wasn't till a point, and then she became supportive of it. Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, she wasn't like super like,
oh, she wasn't gung-ho about,
like, gung-ho, yeah. But she was supportive versus the movie where she is very not supportive of this. And the very end of the movie, she is like, no, I'm, you guys are all leaving the
peace out
fight, and I'm staying behind. And, you know, so then now that we've already kind of veered from the book to a point, not to say he's just going to go in a completely different direction with the next film. Of course, he's going to still adapt the next book.
Right.
But
it makes me curious to see how it's going to be.
Yeah. With that said, am I going to probably listen to it or read it? Almost certainly. Because especially, again, the stuff I've heard about this book, I'm like, no, I got to read this. Because what's going on in this? Like,
from what I understand, like, each book gets a little weirder and weirder. Like, it just kind of starts going off of an end.
Right.
But not that this original book is very super grounded in a lot of stuff.
No, for sure.
Especially when it comes to the whole Jessica thing. So, I mean, you know.
Right.
Anyways. No, I mean, I I'm sad because I know, yeah, people are going to bring up the whole white savior thing. And it's frustrating because, like David said, like, if everybody's going, oh, white savior, I'm like, were you paying, like, is it, were you paying attention to this film? Like, that's kind of the point.
Like, it's clear, the movie, the book, I mean, you know, the author has been, you know, quoted as saying that he was kind of frustrated with some, how some people were still looking at Paul as a hero character, and that's not what he was intending. And I guess, you know, as he continued to write the books, that was almost, I think, sounds like some of the motivation to flesh it out even more for people to be like, look, he is not the
hero.
He's
not
like,
a hero.
Yeah. Anyway, Bobby, you were going to say something.
No, I was just saying, if you really look at how the movie is just on its own, even right. if you don't know the book, you see that there's a division there in terms of people who are stout believers and people who are like more grounded and saying, no, we need to do this for ourselves. We don't need someone else coming in from outside and doing this for us. And it's more to me like, it's a cautionary story more so than like, oh, this white guy is just going to come in and save everything from everybody. Right. So it's very much set up as there's sides. There's not just everybody is on board 100% and willing to follow him to, you know, to the ends of the universe.
It's,
so
it's the Superman paradox.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely that.
Or the Jesus paradox. Well. I mean, whichever way mm-hmm. you want to go with it, but yeah, it's, you know, it's, yeah.
It's fanatical, you know, yeah. It's all kinds of things that are played in there. So you just gotta have to glean it as you watch it and be able to understand it. So I feel like even if I don't watch or don't watch, even if I don't read the next book, Messiah, in between now and the next movie, I am curious enough and feel like I can be held off just slightly enough once we get the Bene Jesuit TV series on Max later this year.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
That'll help.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think it'll help me right. to sort of push it off a little bit, right. just a little bit.
So we all like Dune 2.
We all like Dune 2.
Yep.
I mean, we don't know about Yasha yet, but or also well,
true. It would be it's going to be interesting come award season. You know, it's like so far away. Not to say a movie that comes out in March. I mean, what Everything Everywhere at All at Once came out like early in the year.
It came out in March and mm-hmm. it did very well. But that is really
but you
not
know,
the norm.
It's not the norm.
And to be fair, that doesn't happen in general where. Big contender movie would come out this early. Typically, they all backload them anyway. So
that's what we're saying. Like, they don't start pushing Oscar-ish movies until the fall. And so, like, the great example is Everything Everywhere All at Once, but that is
the anomaly.
That is an anomaly what happened with that one. It's awesome. But
I can't imagine it won't be, you know, in the playing field to come award season, but I hope it is. I mean, obviously we have a lot of year left and a lot of movies to see, but
I think that the thing would be to see how long they can hold off releasing it digitally. And
I think that'll
even happen. Still though, I would say that, and I can't remember, David, if you did this or not on the show or if we talked about it or whatever, but I know that there was lists out there for movies everyone's waiting to see in 2024. And I don't recall, even towards the last year part of the year push, a lot of movies that stood out as sounding like they could be the contenders, where there's just ones you just know. Like this past year, of course you know something like Oppenheimer will. Of course you know something like Killers of the Flower Moon will. Of course you know, there's ones where you just kind of know. And then there's ones like Holdovers and American Fiction. You don't quite know, but you could say, okay, I could see on paper this cast and this director might be in contention. But I don't recall from 2024's list of movies to see there being a lot of things that stood out as front and center as something like Dune did, Dune Part 2.
Yeah, I don't recall either, but I guess I feel like a lot of those lists that I, you know, probably saw, at least going into 2024, were the kind of lists, and you know what I'm talking about, where they mostly seem to focus on, like, the, you know, the wide release, big budget kind of movies that were all like, oh, Deadpool and Wolverine, and we're looking forward to Moana 2, and, you know, stuff like that. But with that said, no, yeah, so I don't remember really seeing a lot of stuff that was like, yep, that's definitely going to be Oscar bait, and that's definitely going to be Oscar bait. Like, Well, unless you guys have anything else, I think we're going to wrap it up.
Well, one quick thing I'll say. If you did, whoever is listening out there, watch Dune Part 2 and really enjoyed it and are looking for something that can at least hold you over a little bit until June when House of the Dragon returns. Check out Shogun on FX. It's really good. It's been 2 episodes and it has that same sort of houses vying for power kind of feel to it as well. And really well done and visually just stunning looking as well. So check that out.
Very cool. With that, we're going to wrap things up. As always, we'd love to hear back from you. If you're listening, please reach out to us on Twitter, on Instagram, on wherever you're listening to podcasts. Leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. But yeah, you can find us, by the way, on Instagram and Twitter or X at Flickr_effect. With that, I'm Dave Lott.
I'm Bobby Jackson.
And I'm Michelle Hillard.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.